Good day, and welcome to the Presidential Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Todd. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today. I'll call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice to order. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important commission teleconference meeting. This is our second call of the week, and I just wanted to take a moment to reinforce that the Attorney General recently said in his video message to law enforcement. If you saw that video, he graciously thanked them for their incredible service and sacrifice, especially during the pandemic COVID-19 virus that's devastating many of our communities. Attorney General routinely thanks law enforcement. However, in this message, he wanted to place a special emphasis on his support for law enforcement, ending his remarks with, end quote, "He has your back," end quote. This is a tribute to law enforcement that continues throughout the Department of Justice and with President Trump. Also, I know the shift in the teleconferences hasn't been easy and without challenges. However, we're sincerely appreciative of the nearly 200 professionals that are involved in the work of the commission, including more than 150 working group members, 17 commissioners, and nearly 30 staff and DOJ leadership members, as well as the FBI providing the teleconference network and coordination. Vice Chairman Katie Sullivan and I simply can't say it enough. We thank you for all your great efforts, and particularly under these trying conditions. At this time, I'd like to ask the Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct our roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, I'd just like to remind everybody that the event today is open to the press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have any questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department's Office of Public Affairs. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll begin the roll. Commissioner Bowditch.
Here.
Commissioner Clemens.
Here.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier. Commissioner Galtieri.
Here.
Commissioner Hawkins.
Present.
Commissioner Lombardo.
Here, thank you.
Commissioner McDonald.
Present.
Commissioner Moody.
Here.
Commissioner Parr.
Here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
I'm here.
Commissioner Rausch.
Here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
Here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
Here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
Here.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Great. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you. Any other announcements, Dean?
No, sir. We're good to go.
Okay. For the commissioners, we did receive a written testimony for today, but it was late this morning, and we'll be including that testimony in your weekly update and scheduling package that will be coming out later this week. Our focus today continues to be on crime reduction, and our panel will focus on the issue of criminal gun crimes and related violence. All the commissioners should have received agendas and bios for this week. We certainly appreciate your patience as we continue adjusting and enhancing our processes. We'll make sure that you have transcripts for all these calls, and once we've received the final written testimonies, we'll forward those to you in addition to being posted on the commission's website. As noted on previous commission calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the panels, and we'll open the questions at the end of the testimony. Our first distinguished witness is Tom Cheatham. He's Assistant Director at the ATF. Mr. Cheatham, thank you for joining us today. You're now recognized.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon. It is my distinct honor and privilege to testify before you today. As you noted, my name is Tom Cheatham, and I serve as the Assistant Director of Field Operations for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. For more than 20 years, I have worked alongside the men and women of ATF to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous criminals. And my testimony today will explain some of the ways criminals arm themselves, including the emerging threat posed by privately made firearms, or what many call ghost guns, and what law enforcement prosecutors can do about it. But first, it's necessary to understand some things about federal firearms law. Congress passed the Gun Control Act of 1968, or the GCA, to expand interstate commerce controls over common firearms like pistols, revolvers, shotguns, and rifles. And it requires those who are, quote, engaged in the business of manufacturing or dealing in firearms to be licensed by ATF. And these federal firearms licensees, or FFLs, are required to mark their firearms, serial numbers, and keep records of their transactions. The GCA also prohibits certain categories of persons, like convicted felons, domestic abusers, illegal drug users, and others, from possessing firearms at all. And to help enforce these prohibitions, Congress passed the Brady Act in 1993, creating the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, and requiring FFLs to submit potential firearms purchaser information to NICS before transferring firearms. Now, Congress expressly passed the GCA to help law enforcement in the fight against crime and violence, but added that it was not to place any undue burdens on law-abiding citizens who use firearms for lawful personal purposes. So, while the GCA requires FFLs to mark firearms with serial numbers and to keep records of sales, it does not impose these same requirements on an unlicensed person. An unlicensed person can privately sell a firearm under no obligation to keep a record of the sale or conduct a background check. Similarly, an unlicensed person can privately make a firearm and is in no under obligation to place a serial number on it nor register it. And this is lawful as long as the person's activities are not to such an extent that he'd be considered engaged in the business. There's no bright line number to determine this, but rather it's a fact-specific legal determination that can only be made through the application of a number of factors. And indeed, it is a crime under the GCA to engage in the business of dealing in firearms without a license, though it does require proof of willful violation. We know that the vast majority of firearms in America are in the hands of responsible, law-abiding adults, and only a small fraction of firearms will ever be used by a relatively few people to commit violent crime. Many of these people are already prohibited from possessing firearms, and they obtain their guns in a variety of ways. Many turn to what are generally called firearms traffickers, but firearms trafficking is not a legal term, it's a law enforcement term. There is no federal firearms trafficking statute. Rather, people who move firearms from the legal market to the illegal market are prosecuted for underlying crimes, such as making false statements, willfully dealing in firearms without a license, or transferring firearms to a prohibited person. Criminals also steal firearms. Between 2012 and 2017, ATF documented the theft of over 40,000 firearms from FFLs. These thefts occur many ways, but often involve smash-and-grab burglaries. But federal law does not require FFLs to implement any particular security measures. In the same period, however, over 1.8 million firearms were estimated to be stolen from individual gun owners, vehicles, and residences, dwarfing the number stolen from FFLs. FFLs are a critical partner in promoting public safety because, among other things, they keep firearms out of the hands of prohibited persons by running NICS checks and ensuring guns can be traced by keeping accurate records. Generally, people prohibited from possessing firearms do not attempt to purchase them directly from FFLs, but when they do, in what is known as a lion try, NICS background checks generally deny them. In 2018, NICS denied about 100,000 transactions. However, in a little over 4,000 of these cases, a firearm was transferred before NICS completed its check, but after the 3 business days, an FFL must wait. These delayed denials trigger retrievals by ATF. More commonly, criminals defeat the controls placed on the retail market through the use of straw purchasers. They recruit the actual buyer recruits a person with a clean background to complete the required paperwork, pass the NICS background check, and purchase a firearm on their behalf, concealing the actual buyer's identity. Some turn to the private market. Rather than risk getting arrested for theft or creating a paper trail or recruiting a straw purchaser, they turn to private sellers, since these unlicensed persons are not required to keep any records of their sales. Private sellers often advertise firearms for sale through social media, on internet websites, in newspaper classified ads, or display them at gun shows. And finally, we come to privately made firearms. With increasing frequency, criminals are making firearms themselves or buying them from someone who made them. You'll recall that the GCA allows an unlicensed person to make a firearm and does not require them to put a serial number on it. Federal law does not define what these privately made firearms should be called, which has led to a variety of monikers, including ghost guns, homemade guns, self-made firearms, do-it-yourself or DIY guns, kit guns, and others. And while the phenomena of privately made firearms is not new, until recently it was mostly the pursuit of hobbyists or firearms enthusiasts. It also required a certain level of skill and equipment. However, over the last several years, commercially manufactured kits have made it increasingly easy to make a firearm at home. The GCA regulates firearms, not firearms parts. And under the GCA, a firearm is defined as a weapon which will or is designed to or may readily be converted to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive, but it also includes the frame or receiver of such a weapon. This sounds simple enough, but determining whether an item meets one of these prongs and therefore is a firearm under the GCA requires a careful case-by-case legal and technical analysis. ATF assesses, for instance, whether an item has certain holes or cavities that allow it to accept fire control parts or whether it requires additional machining. And fixing the precise point at which an item has reached such a sufficient stage of manufacture that it goes beyond being an unregulated piece of metal to being a regulated firearm does not lend itself to bright lines. Many people who make firearms start with a blank. But increasingly, companies sell kits that allow people to use the materials, tools, and instructions provided to finish the blank into a firearm frame or receiver. Some even push legal boundaries and sell them with most or all the parts necessary to make a completed firearm. The tutorials on how to finish and assemble these firearms abound online. Although it's possible to make a firearm using a 3D printed firearms are for the most part not common and generally not durable. We've seen very few recovered in crimes, though that may change as technology becomes more affordable and widespread. If an item's not a firearm under the GCA, a felon can easily obtain one without a background check, can order it online, and it can be sent through the mail. And once assembled, it actually is a firearm, both under the GCA, but also in fact, and it can shoot and it can kill. And because they're not serialized and do not require record keeping, it is challenging for law enforcement to identify the source of these firearms. There are no reliable statistics on how many privately made firearms are being recovered in crimes, but we do know from data from ATF investigations, the Tracing Center, our NIBIN Center, and verifiable information from local jurisdictions that these firearms are increasingly common. This issue first rose to prominence in California and continues to be prominent there. However, we've seen them spread to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago, and other metropolitan areas. ATF has documented recoveries in 38 states, plus D.C., Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. While there were only three firearms recovered in D.C. in 2017, three privately made firearms, 25 were recovered in 2018, and 116 in 2019. ATF has seized an increasing number of firearms every year since 2016. We know that at least 1,678 of these firearms have been entered into NIBIN, and that 10% of them were linked to shooting incidents. This is higher than the overall rate of 7.2% for commercially made firearms submitted to NIBIN, suggesting they're being obtained specifically for criminal use. ATF has also seen them used as a source of supply for unlicensed dealers and other firearms traffickers, including to Mexico, where they help fuel cartel-related violence. We have seen these not just used in regular crimes, but in headline-making crimes. In a mass shooting in November of 2017 in Northern California, where a man used one to kill five people. Last year, a privately made AR-15-type rifle was used to murder a California Highway Patrol officer. And in November last year, a 16-year-old high school student in Santa Clarita, California, used one to kill two high school students and himself. I have a few recommendations on what law enforcement and prosecution can do about this. First, train officers in basic firearms investigation and train them to interrogate armed criminals about the source of their firearms. Aggressively pursue investigations of illegal sources of crime guns and work diligently to solve thefts. embrace the principles of crime gun intelligence, including comprehensively tracing and submitting to NIBIN all firearms, including privately made firearms. Aggressively prosecute not just criminals that use or possess firearms, but also the traffickers, armed, unlicensed dealers, and straw purchasers that arm them. Engage in outreach to private gun owners on how to protect themselves against theft. Engage in media outreach to publicize and deter firearms trafficking offenses. And establish and maintain relationships with FFLs and encourage them to adopt security best practices. And finally, partnership. None of us can tackle violent crime alone, and if you don't already have one, please establish a strong working relationship with the ATF. After working nearly half my life alongside them, I know the men and women of ATF are some of the bravest, hardest working, and most effective public servants on the planet. And this concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Director Chittum, for your valued and informative testimony today. We also thank you for your distinguished service to our country. Our next witness is Melissa Nelson, who is the State Attorney for Florida's 4th Judicial District. State Attorney Nelson's 2020 strategic plan is laser focused on criminal prosecution, and we're eager to hear her hear the testimony she has to provide us today. General Nelson, you're recognized.
Director Keith, thank you. Vice Chair Sullivan and Commissioners, thank you for having me today, and my thanks to all of you for your important work on these important issues. My name is Melissa Nelson, and I'm an elected state attorney in the state of Florida. My jurisdiction includes Jacksonville, which is the largest city in Northeast Florida. I've been asked to speak with you today about prosecutorial strategies that our office has implemented in our community's effort to reduce violent crime. Obviously, prosecution is different from policing, and unlike the police, we do not deploy to hotspots in an effort to deter crime, and our mere presence does nothing to prevent crime. As I often explain in speeches, prosecutors typically get involved after the bad thing has already happened. This said, I and my team really believe that a prosecutor's office can contribute to crime reduction efforts in meaningful ways. So we've launched over the course of the last 3 years a number of strategies focused on how we as an office advance the goal of violent crime reduction. And all that we have done is included in our written submission, but in my brief remarks today, I'll highlight some of those actions that we've taken that I think lend themselves to easy replication by other offices. So here in Jacksonville, we face many of the same challenges as do large metropolitan areas nationwide. And while I don't need to go over or restate, obviously, the gun problem that exists throughout our country, I will give you a flavor of the state of violence and gun violence in our city. To date this year, there have been 44 murders in Jacksonville and well over 100 shootings where a bullet has struck a body. And sadly, frankly, since COVID-19, our shootings and homicides have escalated. Gun violence has persisted as a significant problem in our city for decades. In 2019, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office implemented the ShotSpotter gunfire detection technology, and now as prosecutors, we can hear these shootings, and I'm going to play one for you. I play this because hearing what is happening on the ground in some areas of our city is obviously much more powerful than my testimony about it. Less than 1 in 5 of these shooters, of these shootings that is captured by this technology is actually ever called into 911. This high level of violence is directly attributable to a very small population of prolific shooters. So our office decided that this population of violent and dangerous offenders deserved our laser-focused attention, and several things flowed from this decision. First, we changed our office's organizational structure, standing up a division staffed with experienced and talented prosecutors, embedding those prosecutors with our law enforcement partners. This unit is designed to focus on the drivers of violent crime. The division is called the Targeted Prosecution Division. We have incorporated state-of-the-art technology in both our investigations and prosecutions of violent crime. and we have been both aggressive and creative to prosecute more fully and intentionally the most dangerous offenders. Separate from enforcement and prosecution, but as equally as important, we've also invested much in building partnerships with our community to advance prevention and intervention efforts to reduce crime. We're using NIBIN in a very different way than we have for the last many decades. Instead of waiting months for a lab to advise of a potential match between a casing and a gun, we're using this technology as a powerful lead generator to give us a picture of how and where a crime gun is traveling. We've enhanced our collaboration with our law enforcement partners by embedding our targeted prosecutors with them. Last year, we cut the ribbon on our Crime Gun Intelligence Center. I understand that Chief Newdegate is going to talk more in depth with you about the value of CGIC for us. It has become a hub of intelligence, technology, and communication. Our weekly CGIC meetings include local and federal law enforcement partners and state and federal prosecutors. And the benefit of the integration with law enforcement ensures that we, as prosecutors, are recognizing early and relevant intelligence regarding shootings and shooters that previously would have gone unlinked. Since we as prosecutors are responsible for seeing a case through to its end, the sharing of intelligence at inception of a case is vitally important in the development of a strong case for prosecution. And this is true even in nonviolent cases involving target offenders. The earlier grim statistic about having only one in five of these incidents of gunfire ever being called into 911, for me, underscores the challenge that exists for prosecutors of making these cases. Witness participation continues to haunt not only us here in Jacksonville, but prosecutors throughout the country. So where we can't make prosecutorial cases on shootings, we target the shooters for prosecution in other ways. Many of the shooters are prohibited from having firearms because they have prior felony convictions. So we've engaged in a thorough audit of our prosecutions of prohibited offenders. And several innovations came from this audit, which you can read about in our written submission. These include a checklist, a risk assessment tool, both designed to ensure that we leave no stone unturned in every single gun case we handle. And most recently, a visor card for law enforcement to assist law enforcement in making the very best case they can from moment one on the street. We've tried to think outside of the box. We've initiated novel prosecutions against prohibited carriers and shooters who brazenly show off their semi-automatic and automatic rifles, extended and drum magazines on their social media platforms. We have used their own videos, words, and photos against them, even in cases where we don't have the firearm itself. And while we've been very strategic and deliberate in our prosecution of the most significant public safety threats, we know that enforcement cannot be the sole answer in any crime reduction strategy. And so to that end, we have engaged our community stakeholders to expand and enhance our front-end prevention and intervention efforts. And these efforts are also outlined in our written submission and our three-year strategic plan. So recommendations that we can share, also outlined in our written submission, but for other prosecutor offices. You heard about partnerships. They're absolutely vital to the success of any crime reduction strategy. Convene stakeholders to assess collaborative violence reduction strategies and then put pen to paper. That's what we did. Draft an organizational long-term vision and plan of action. And you can find an example of our written violence reduction strategy in our submission. Analyze internal organizational structures and strategically deploy prosecutorial resources to embed with law enforcement partners. Know what violence reduction initiatives exist with law enforcement partners and figure out as a prosecutor's office how to support those. Utilize audits of prosecutions to understand how gun cases are being handled and then mitigate against any identified issues. Assess process and business operations to determine efficiencies that will allow law enforcement partners to actually stay in service. Create a tool for prosecuting gun possessions that includes crime gun possessions or prohibited persons that includes criteria and enhancements for identifying high-risk offenders. Analyze local crime data to determine where violence is occurring and the nature of that violence. If you don't have a CGIC and you're not using NIBIN in the way that we should be using it today, then seek grant funding for both. And if you do have a CEJIC, ensure you're maximizing the benefit of that CEJIC. Who attends the weekly meetings? Are all appropriate agencies and prosecutors there? Prioritize innovation and technology to improve prosecutions. And we, this is also outlined in more detail in our submission, specifically identify an asset for technological education and training. In fact, we have a prosecutor who we've invested much time training across the United States on technology, and she's currently leading a digital forensic task force. And recognizing that enforcement is not the sole solution to reducing violent crime, focus efforts on community partnerships, prevention, and interventions to minimize a population from coming into the criminal justice system. So I'll close with this in preparation for today and writing our paper and drafting my testimony. A common theme definitely kept coming to the surface, and that was one of collaboration and partnership. In the exploration and implementation of every initiative that we've employed, we've definitely taken a collaborative approach in forging partnerships. And we've prioritized the investment in long-term sustainable solutions. That concludes my testimony. Thank you again for your commitment to this most important issue, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, General Nelson, for your testimony and your pursuit of justice for the safety of our citizens. Our next witness is Paul Newdegate, who is an assistant chief in the Cincinnati Police Department. Assistant Chief Newdegate was instrumental in bringing shot detection technology to Cincinnati to address gun crime in that city. Chief Newdegate, thank you for joining us today. You're now recognized.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Director Keith and Commissioners. Paul Newdegate, 31-year veteran of law enforcement. I currently serve as the Assistant Chief of Operations for the Cincinnati Police Department, where we have 1,000 sworn officers and serve a population of just over 300,000. We know many large urban cities are impacted by recurring gun violence, and Cincinnati is no exception. We have a tremendous amount of gun violence for a city our size, but we have implemented certain strategies over the last 3 years that have shown great promise, so I do appreciate this opportunity to speak before the Commission regarding some proven solutions that are working in Cincinnati and other cities that have adopted a crime gun intelligence approach to gun crime. So in 2015, we had almost 500 individuals shot in the city with a population, as I said, of just 300,000. So we knew we had to have a paradigm shift in how we were addressing shooting victimization. And knowing that we have a strong no-snitching culture in Cincinnati, and much like other urban areas, we realized we had to do a better job of using evidence-based technology to help overcome those gaps in community cooperation. So through the use of technology, a change in strategy, and strengthening our relationships with many of our federal partners, specifically the ATF and the U.S. Attorney's Office of the Southern District of Ohio, we were able to reduce shootings by almost a third, 30%, by 2018. So in 3 years, Cincinnati Police Department was able to reduce the number of people shot in Cincinnati from 479 in 2015 to 333 shooting victims in 2018. That was 169 fewer victims of gun violence. And I do attribute this substantial reduction to six initiatives that we've implemented, which really comes down to a layered strategy based upon the principles of crime gun intelligence, and that is the use of NIBIN, the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network, E-Trace, gunshot detection, focus on priority offenders, enhanced federal prosecution, and has been mentioned previously, relationships. For those that don't know what NIBIN is, it is a ballistic imaging network managed and operated by ATF, where they look at the characteristics of fired cartridge casings to include breech face, ejector marks, and firing pin impressions. Those are then compared against shell casings and firearms recovered at crime scenes. These correlations produce investigative leads that allow us to identify those involved in gun crimes, and especially our repeat trigger pullers. So in 2015, when we had this large spike in shooting violence, we were approached by ATF, and they extolled the virtue of how NIBIN could help us reduce gun violence. So in conjunction with ATF, we began a test pilot project, and during this period, we had an extremely high-profile incident where on four separate occasions, in a one-week period, a suspect shot into one of our local office towers in the heart of downtown Cincinnati. No one was injured, but you can imagine the panic it created in our community. So while we worked the traditional investigative angles, we submitted the ballistic evidence, the shell casings, to ATF through a neighboring site. And several weeks later, we caught a running gun battle on video, able to identify the primary suspect, take him into custody. We recovered a firearm. That handgun was test-fired, entered into NIBIN, matched the shell casings from our Queen City Tower shooting. Now, this suspect had absolutely no ties to the crime and never would have emerged as a suspect. He subsequently admitted to the offenses, was prosecuted federally, sentenced to 8 years incarceration. And I can say, without NIBIN, we would not have solved this crime. And also in 2016, shortly after the murders of five Dallas officers, we had suspects drive by one of our districts and fire shots into the front of it. Because of Dallas, officers were already had heightened concern, and this only increased it. So we recovered numerous .45 casings from the scene, immediately entered into NIBIN, which linked to a previous shooting incident with three identified suspects. Less than 72 hours from the time they shot into our district, we arrested these three individuals who we believe were the perpetrators on new gun and drug charges, and I can tell you there were no other shots fired into any of our facilities. So these are just two of several hundreds of examples where NIBIN has helped us link gun crimes, identify shooters, and bring forth charges. So let me emphatically state, when operationalized properly, NIBIN is the cornerstone of any successful crime gun intelligence initiative, and it will reduce gun violence. But to see the benefit of NIBIN, we must make sure that agencies are adhering to the four critical steps of NIBIN, which have been incorporated into the minimum required operating standards, which are comprehensive collection, timely turnaround, investigative follow-up, and feedback. Then we talk about eTrace, also managed by the ATF, where it's a firearm trace submission system that provides local law enforcement the identity of the original purchaser of a firearm. Now, this capability, when layered with NIBIN, provides important investigative leads. Last year, we had an individual abducted, shot in the head, and left for dead. 2 days after this crime, officers arrested an individual nearby for being a felon in possession of a handgun. It was entered into NIBIN, and because of the close proximity of the arrest to the offense, we requested an urgent expedited trace. Trace indicated that the firearm had been purchased in a neighboring state by a female just 3 days prior. Officers and agents went to the gun store. They were able to secure video of this purchase. The female purchaser was seen on that video being accompanied by the male felon that we found in possession of the gun. Follow-up interview with that female led to a confession for her involvement in not just the straw purchase, but also the abduction and the shooting. Follow-up search warrants, interviews, we arrested three other individuals, including the male who pulled the trigger. So with the expedited trace results, we were able to obtain the video before it reached its retention period and was deleted. And without the timely trace return, we would not have had this crucial investigative lead. And eTrace is not only beneficial in following up on these criminal acts, but it also allows us to identify those federal firearms licensees who have an excessive amount of their firearms involved in our violent crime so that we can ask for additional scrutiny of their practices to ensure firearms are not being diverted into the hands of criminals. Now, CPD traces every firearm that comes into our possession, but unfortunately due to antiquated tracing laws, the time frame between the trace request and the return often robs investigators of leads that we could use to remove violent felons. Now, I realize that this process is mandated by Congress and that there are privacy concerns related to the Second Amendment. However, I urge the Commission to find common ground between these concerns and allow ATF to provide us these timely trace results. In regards to gunshot detection, Cincinnati has utilized it since 2017. Found it invaluable in many ways. It's made it for officers safer for officers to respond to shots fired calls, as the technology pinpoints the location of the gunfire, identify repeat locations of gunfire for follow-up intervention, identify and respond to shootings and shots fired incidents where no 911 call was received, as well as allowing detectives to use the technology to validate or refute accounts of shooting incidents provided by victims, witnesses, and suspects. However, I think one of the areas where we're deficient in realizing the advantages of gunshot detection is in community engagement. Cincinnati, much like our previous presenter indicated, Ms. Nelson, that we only receive a companion call to 911 on 16% of our gunshot activations. That means 84% of the time, the police are not notified, not responding, and are unaware of criminal activity in the communities we swore to protect. We know that there are many factors, but unfortunately, this generates the belief that the police don't care when we're only responding 16% of the time one of our communities is in crisis. Now, prior to our first implementation, we did an informal survey to gauge the effectiveness of the technology, and we asked the community, how would you prioritize CPD in addressing gun violence in your community? What I can say is the initial results were not what we had hoped for, but they were not surprising. But when we conducted a follow-up survey 6 months later, when we were now responding 100% of the time a gun is fired in that community, the favorable results increased by 20%. Now, I do realize this was a non-formal survey, and that's why we're partnering with the University of Cincinnati currently for Institutional Review Board approval for our future expansions. One of the things that's also worked well for us is addressing priority offenders. In Cincinnati, the traditional gang structure does not exist. Our groups are fluid. They cross boundaries. Realizing that only a small percentage actually drive our violent crime, we adjusted our model. In 2007, when our sole strategy was group violence interruption, we had over 2,000 identified group or gang members we sought to disrupt. Now we have approximately 50 individuals at any given time that we focus on. Our results have shown that for Cincinnati, the removal of one priority offender can make a greater and long-lasting impact than disrupting a group or gang. The benefit of having this laser-focused approach on the drivers of violent crime, while also reducing not just violent but also Part 1, is our community no longer feels, from our experience, that they're under siege from their law enforcement agency like it used to when we made substantially more arrests. And I can't speak to the federal prosecution. Ohio, like many states, has extremely lax gun laws, especially for repeat violent felons who are arrested time after time for illegally possessing firearms. So as a result, we present significantly more cases to our U.S. attorney, who has been a great partner in helping us reduce shooting violence. Our data shows a distinct reduction in shooting violence when these repeat career felons are removed from the community. I can say unequivocally, we would not have retained the reduction in shooting violence were it not for the additional cases our federal prosecutors have adopted for us. It's a reoccurring theme, relationships and partnerships. I've talked about the technology, the NIBIN, the E-Trace, the gunshot detection. But what makes us all work in concert are the relationships and the collaboration. And all of our federal partners, they work in conjunction with Cincinnati Police to reduce crime, U.S. Attorney's Office, FBI, DEA. But I have to say that the ATF has been invaluable in helping us remove violent felons from the community. They are the federal agency that has the most co-aligned mission of working with and assisting local law enforcement in addressing shooting and gun violence. Without ATF, we would not have begun utilizing NIBIN and E-Trace. Without ATF, the use of gunshot detection would not be as effective, as we would lack the ability to link the recovered shell casings to crime and individuals. And finally, to close, the use of technology is allowing us to be laser-focused in our enforcement efforts. We equate it to fishing with a spear and not a net, which has a less harmful impact on our communities. Technology is not perfect, but it does help us overcome some of the implicit bias humans have regarding race, gender, and economic status. What I'll say is crime gun intelligence is a layered, holistic approach, and when implemented properly, and augmented with the right relationships and strategies is that game changer law enforcement has been looking for. I have a few recommendations for the commission. Expand Bureau of Justice Assistance grant funding for additional crime gun intelligence centers across the country. Increase funding for ATF to continue to expand its national network of NIBIN sites, as well as continued funding for the NIBIN National Correlation and Training Center. Expand grant funding for the acquisition and use of gunshot detection. Consider making non-crime gun intelligence grant funding dependent on the effective use of NIBIN and adherence to the principles identified in the minimum required operating standards. Encourage the Department of Justice to take an even larger role in prosecuting violent career felons to overcome deficiencies in the state court system. And last, if addressing gun violence is a national priority, and as ATF has the most co-aligned mission with local law enforcement, the least amount of sworn agents of any of the major federal law enforcement agencies, increase the sworn complement of ATF field agents.
Thank you, Chief Newgate, for your valued testimony and for your distinguished 31 years of service. Our final panelist today is distinguished U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, Zachary Telliger. Excuse me, Attorney. U.S. Telliger is the distinguished career, has a distinguished career with the Department of Justice, serving as Associate Deputy Attorney General, Assistant U.S. Attorney, and now is the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. As a prosecutor, he has prosecuted numerous violent crimes, fraud, organized crime, gangs, and human trafficking, as well as managed large law enforcement task forces focusing on human trafficking, gangs, and firearms. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Telliger. You're recognized.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. It's been a curse ever since I was born. It's Terwilliger. But thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify before this group. And let me just commend you and all the other commissioners for pushing forward amid the COVID pandemic. I believe it's more important than ever that we engage in this work, that the wheels of justice continue to move. And I just want to thank all of the law enforcement on this call and those participating as commissioners. I'm just in awe of what you all are doing and being out there on the front lines. And it is my hope and one of the things I've tried to do on the limited mantle I have, that one of the silver linings of this entire pandemic is that we restore the appreciation and respect that's due to state and local law enforcement. So thank you for having me. As the final guest batting cleanup, as it were, I know also want to make sure you have plenty of time for your questions. I'll keep my testimony today succinct, and part of the reason for that is I'm so pleased to be on this panel with my co-panelists because I know each and every one of them, and I know them because ATF was forward-thinking enough to create a national board related to crime gun intelligence. And so I have spent multiple multi-day, all-day conferences with Chief Newgate, with State's Attorney Nelson, and with Director Chittum, as well as Director Lombardo, who I know is listening in as well. So a lot of what you're hearing today and the synergies that you've heard each and every one of the panelists discuss have been borne out by that board on which we all serve. So I just want to, similar to the chief, I want to commend ATF for their forward thinking on this. In talking about gun violence in America from the federal prosecution perspective, I've been a prosecutor in DOJ for about 11 years now, and I got my start under Project Safe Neighborhood 1.0, which was something that was done under the George W. Bush administration. And the idea there was to go after guns and gangs because they were the violent crime rate was going up, and we needed a focus and a way to bring it back down. And so I originally got my start as a prosecutor as what they call a Project Safe Neighborhood SALSA, where I was actually a cross-designated assistant attorney general and a special assistant United States attorney. So my entire experience for the first two or three years as a federal prosecutor was doing exactly what we're here to talk about today, and that's going to inform my opinion. what I've noticed and what I believe we are faced with now, especially when this administration started, was an increase in violent crime, as we all know. One of the things that the data tells us is we started to see an uptick in violent crime in particular. One of the things that had fallen by the wayside were some of our best practices from Project Safe Neighborhood 1.0, and you saw then Attorney General Sessions institute Project Safe Neighborhood 2.0, and then Attorney General Barr has really doubled that effort with Operation Relentless Pursuit, which I think the commission held about yesterday, and Project Guardian. Project Guardian is very similar to predecessor Project Trigger Lock, as well as Project Exile, which was a program that was utilized in the Eastern District of Virginia back in the late 90s, early 2000s in Richmond, Virginia, where it cut the homicide rate in half. And the whole notion behind those programs was we are going to focus on the trigger pullers. We are going to focus on the firearms. We're not going after people, as the chief just said perfectly. We're not going to go after people with a net and round up everybody. We're going to go after the people who are committing a disproportionate amount of crime and violent crime, and we're going to fish with a proverbial spear, not the net. And that's what these new programs, Project Guardian, Operation Relentless Pursuit, and Project Safe Neighborhood 2.0 do. So if the goal and the problem we're trying to address is gun violence in America, that's what we're doing. And not to repeat what others have said, but in a nutshell, what we are doing is we are trying to disrupt the shooting cycle by getting individuals off the street who have a proclivity for violent crime before they can pull the trigger. One of the ways we're doing that pursuant to Project Guardian, where we are attached at the hip with ATF, has been in our lying and trying and lying and buying cases. So someone goes into an FFL, attempts to acquire a firearm, they're denied because they're prohibited for any number of categories, and we're going after them. The other area that we've done a lot more of, to be frank, is the lying and buying. Someone goes in and purchases a firearm for someone else, and they're not the true purchaser, so committing a straw purchase. The way a lot of those cases have now come about is when that firearm's ultimately recovered by law enforcement. We use our crime gun intelligence model at ATF, which utilizes both NIBIN and E-Trace. In this case, we use E-Trace. So firearms recovered, say, in a fugitive arrest or in a search warrant. The firearm's submitted, it's traced, and it goes back to the last true purchaser. We go to that individual. ATF goes to that individual, typically confronts that individual and says, where's the gun? And we engage in a back and forth with that individual and try to determine how this firearm ultimately wound up where it was recovered. And oftentimes it's that straw purchaser that is the first link in the chain. A practice that had been done and is still being done in some areas were cease and desist letters, where we had individuals we thought were straw purchasing firearms. In the Eastern District of Virginia, along with the District of Maryland and the District of Columbia, we started something called Project Guardian DMV. And what that is, that sort of illustrates this point I'm making. When a firearm is recovered in D.C., we've got a major violence problem, gun violence problem. Those firearms now are being traced, and assuming there is a straw purchaser over in Virginia, which is being treated as a source state, we are now making sure that prosecution doesn't just start and end in D.C. Or Maryland or wherever the gun is ultimately recovered. We now have a task force that's set up to make sure that every one of those guns that's recovered in D.C., if the individual who had the gun was prohibited or wasn't supposed to have it or committed some other crime with it, they're prosecuted there. But then we get a referral back to our district to make sure we're going back to the source of supply, just like you would in a narcotics case. That source of supply being a straw purchaser, perhaps a dirty federal firearms licensee, or something else. And that's what we're doing. And we've seen really good results with that. The word is out amongst this area that Virginia, with its less restrictive firearms laws compared to those in the District of Columbia, which are extremely tight, probably some of the tightest in the nation next to Chicago, we are going to go pursue those cases. In addition, One of the other elements of Project Guardian is making sure we're working with our state and local law enforcement on the NIBIN piece of this, which is comprehensive shell collection. So as you've heard from others who are much more close to it than I am, the whole idea is that when shots are fired, whether someone's hit, whether they're in the air and celebratory, or whether they're at a stop sign, we've got to go collect the shell casings, get those entered into the NIBIN system, so that then when a firearm's ultimately recovered and test fired, we've got a map linking everything together. We had a large operation here just outside D.C. in Alexandria, Virginia, where by using NIBIN and E-Trace, we were able to find guns that were 3 days from time of purchase to time of crime, and then casing that connected what we thought otherwise would have been three unrelated shootings and really cracked the case wide open. And as you've heard from other people, another key piece of that is in an era where we do need to be careful about, you know, what it well, let me put it this way. In an era where it's extremely helpful to follow science and it's helpful to follow the guns rather than be accused of following anything else, or certainly by following skin color or socioeconomic status or things of that nature, it's so helpful to have NIBIN and E-Trace, because every time I have a conversation with the community or with city council members or individuals, I can tell them we're following the guns. We're not targeting individuals. We are targeting firearms, which is incredibly helpful in this day and age. Let me just quickly sum up. One of the other pieces that we're doing under Project Guardian is making sure that we are coordinating our prosecutions with our state and local counterparts. You've heard how forward-leaning District Attorney or State's Attorney Nelson is. You've also heard some of the challenges in certain states from Chief Newgate. In general, we have some really great tools that Congress has given us under the federal system in terms of firearms cases and firearms statutes. So as a result, what we do through these gun coordination meetings is actually sit down with our local counterparts and decide where a particular gun case should go, assuming it's an individual we want to remove from the community for as long as possible. And so we go through that gun coordination process. One of the other things that we are trying to do is, again, choke off the pipeline of firearms that are going out to the street. As we move forward, and as I sum up my testimony, I think what's most important is we don't lose sight of enforcing the firearms laws that we have on the books. I'm not at liberty, and nor is it my place to dictate what firearms laws should be and things like universal background checks. As a member of the Department of Justice, I'm prohibited from pushing forward for legislation. What I can tell you is that under the Project Guardian rubric, the Operation Relentless Pursuit rubric, with the incredible wind that's currently at ATF's back, and they're doubling down on these measures, we are making great inroads. And if we each, state, federal, and local, commit to using the firearms statutes we have, and we commit to doing these cases and pushing these cases, even when federal judges may disagree that they belong in federal court or that, you know, they're, quote, serious enough, we are going to continue to make inroads. We know this is a tried and true method because it worked with Project Safe Neighborhood 1, and it's already working under Project Safe Neighborhood 2 and Project Guardian. As far as recommendations to go for the future, I think to the extent we can continue to prioritize these prosecutions in a world where there's always something that needs our attention, increase coordination. This has to be a federal, state, and local combined effort to work, which it has been, and to just continue to be smart in the ways that we use these statutes so it's not seen as an overreach, but we really do use it to remove those from society who are the disproportionate who commit violent crime. And once again, I just want to thank Director Lombardo and ATF for being such wonderful partners on this. And if Deputy Director Bowditch is on it, a huge thank you to the FBI as well, where these statutes intersect with our human trafficking cases, with our organized crime cases, specifically our transnational gangs. You know, where there's guns, there's gangs, and vice versa. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your informative testimony, Mr. Challenger, and your distinguished service to our country. Commissioners, we're now open for questions, as previously noted. The commissioners with a question should state your name prior to the question and direct the question to a specific panelist. If you have a question for, or if it's for a response from the entire panel, please state so. Just as a reminder, commissioners, your mic's hot at all time. Thank you. Commissioners with questions for our panelists. Commissioners with questions for our panelists.
President Keith, it's Regina Lombardo at ATF. I don't have a specific question. I would probably could not let an opportunity go by today with not saying thank you for the panel. I'm actually very humbled, and I almost have goosebumps as I listen, because these are people I've worked with throughout my career, and especially the last few years. So thank you for your support as we look at everything holistically, and nothing that we do is without our federal partners, the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, the DEA, Department of Justice, as well as definitely our state and local. And this panel, I think, represents that holistic approach of looking at it from every jurisdiction. And so I just want to take a minute to say thank you for your testimony today. And for also the service that you do and for supporting ATF. Thank you.
Hi, it's Katie. How's everyone? Can I ask a question, Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, thank you. All right. So I guess what my question is, I'm thinking about data, right? And I'm thinking about how these projects are all really successful. I'm also thinking about concrete recommendations in our report. Is there a set, is someone keeping track of this already in terms of the increase in just straight up gun cases? And then thinking about how that data is collected, do we have one centralized place where this data is being collected and then reported? So I'm guessing that all the U.S. attorneys know what they're doing, but to create a report that shows this increase in people who have guns that shouldn't have guns or using guns in an inappropriate way, and show how these task forces and cross coordination are working to get those guns off the street could be pretty powerful. So does that exist, or is that a recommendation we could make?
This is Tom Cheatham with the ATF. If I could speak to some of it, I know that some national reliable data is available. For instance, the U.S. Attorney's Office can produce specific statistics on the number of people that are prosecuted for federal firearms violations. ATF can quantify the number of firearms that are submitted, say, for firearms tracing or to the NIBIN Correlation Center, or otherwise submitted into the NIBIN network. We can also account for the number of prosecution recommendations we make. There are specific limitations placed on ATF to which data we can release. And also there's some data, specifically some that I mentioned, that we just can't know yet for a variety of reasons, including lack of standardized definitions, common misidentifications of firearms, and for other reasons. So there is information available, as with most things. I don't think there's nearly as much as we all wish that we had, because in this day and age, intelligence drives how we deploy the limited resources all of us have to contribute to this fight against violent crime.
Thank you.
This is Ashley Moody. I have a question.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
State Attorney Nelson, thank you so much for being with us and for the commissioners as Attorney General in Florida. It's a privilege to work with a state attorney who tries new things and is so dedicated to trying to improve a criminal situation, and we're just so proud to have her in our state. And she talked about ShotSpotter, and I hear this technology being used not only in Florida but in other places throughout our nation, and those that have used it and implemented that technology have said it's been a game changer in many instances. And so I was hoping that State Attorney Nelson might provide us with, for those that don't know what ShotSpotter is, maybe just a brief summary of what that is, her decision to implement that technology, because I think it's so very important as technology is progressing that we use that in law enforcement throughout the nation. So her experience with that, a brief definition of that, just for the commissioner's benefit.
General Moody, thank you very much, and thanks for the question. So I can't take credit for the deployment of it here. Our sheriff's office, starting in early 2019, has decided to utilize this technology, and it has been a game changer for us. It is a piece, as Chief Newdigate explained, of a multi-pronged approach to fighting gun violence. And so just to give you a brief description of what it is, it's audio technology that is strategically placed in cities where there's where certain areas are experiencing significant gunfire. In our city, it's placed in a 5-square-mile radius, and it literally, as you heard, detects gunfire, and it can distinguish gunfire from a car backfiring. And for those of us, all of law enforcement in Jacksonville, and for the prosecutors who are dealing with these crimes in our office, we all have the technology actually on our phone. So we get an alert when shots are fired, and we can, in real time, listen not only to the shots fired, but to the patrol officer on the street. It gives the patrol officer literally an area within just square inches of where the shots were fired. That, in combination with the usage of NIBIN, which is in the collection of brass, is particularly important. So two of us shared with you the lack of call-ins on this gunfire. So we've got communities plagued by violence where people are listening routinely to gunfire and not, for whatever reason, calling it in. Before we used ShotSpotter, law enforcement didn't even know about those shootings. Now they know about them, they're alerted to them, and they go and they are charged whether there are people at the scene or not. In some cases, we've saved lives because there's been a victim on the ground dying, but in many cases, we may not have a bullet that meets flesh, but there will be cartridge casings there. So law enforcement is charged with the collection of that brass, and then putting those cartridge casings utilizing the NIBIN technology. I mentioned in my testimony, NIBIN has been around for a long time, and we've used, obviously, our state labs. Historically, we would only submit evidence if we had cartridge casings and a gun that we wanted to see if there might be a match. Now, with the collection of cartridge casings and putting them into the database, we are within 48 to 72 hours in real time being told that those casings match another shooting scene. So that tells us it's a lead generator. That tells us that crime gun has been used in at least two scenes, sometimes three, and it will tell us, we know if that scene is 2 weeks ago or 2 years ago. And obviously crime guns can change hands, but it's a significant piece of intelligence when we know two or more shooting scenes are linked. So it's the technology of ShotSpotter used in combination with the collection of cartridge casings and then the input of those casings into NIBIN that obviously grows the database and gives us linkages to shootings. And then the Crime Gun Intelligence Center is where is the collaboration for all the different technology, and in our weekly meetings where we actually go over NIBIN leads. So we will have a detective explain this shooting is linked to this shooting and share intelligence related to those different shooting scenes. I'll finish with one more thing. Chief Newdigate mentioned this, but our local law enforcement has experienced an unexpected benefit from the deployment of ShotSpotter. In neighborhoods where 80% of the shootings are not being called in, there is no law enforcement response to those shootings. And so now that law enforcement is actually showing up because they know about it, not from a 911 call, but because of this technology, they are finding that neighborhoods have expressed, Chief Newdegate talked about this anecdotally, but we're seeing the same thing, a level of appreciation that law enforcement is responding. So that doesn't help us necessarily solve crime, though we have had cases where a witness will come out and talk to law enforcement. But it really has been a very, very important piece to fighting violent crime. So thank you, General Moody, for the question.
Other commissioners with questions?
I feel this, Don Washington. I have a question for Melissa Nelson and for Zach Twilliger.
Yes, you're recognized, Director.
Yeah, my question involves the participation of other district attorneys in this effort around the country. You know, there's been some press about some DAs, pretty much in some of the larger cities, that have a different view about crime and punishment than other more traditional district attorneys and state's attorneys have had. And curious as to what your opinions are as to what we might be able to say about that issue.
Zach, do you want to take lead on that?
Sure. Thank you very much. Yes, so it is, you're absolutely right, Director. It varies. I think the most clear example is what we see in Philadelphia, where there's just, truly, in my opinion, an abdication of responsibility to enforce the law. And we have that in other places as well. As you may be aware, given where Marshall's headquarters is, we have newly elected district attorneys in Fairfax and in Arlington, which were quote-unquote progressive reformers who were backed by individuals with a bent towards a very, very different approach than your traditional law and order prosecutions. My own experience has been, we try to work with everybody at the state level, and we work with those who will work with us. And so we have very good relationships in most of the Commonwealth. There are areas where we don't, but one of the things, even when we've had the breakdown amongst the we call them Commonwealth attorneys here, but state's attorneys, we've been able to work with local law enforcement. Oftentimes that can be a little bit difficult for the various chiefs of police, and others can speak more to that. But where we've even had a situation where a local prosecutor does not want to go forward with a case, we've been able to work with a law enforcement agency, assuming we have a federal predicate, to move forward. And one of the areas where I think you're going to see more and more of that is in the domestic violence context. Traditionally a state offense, but pursuant to the 922G suite of offenses, if you're a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, if you have a conviction for that, you're prohibited as well as if you have a final protective order. And we're going to be more and more forward-leaning in those instances. So it's a problem. I think it's absolutely something that this commission needs to look at, because ultimately there are certain things, we can do straw purchase cases, we can do felon in possession cases, which usually there's a state corollary for. However, when it comes to just general violent crime, unless it happens on federal property or involves, a gang or there's drug trafficking, oftentimes we don't have jurisdiction. So I think that's a very important point. I think what I serve on the Attorney General's Advisory Committee, and when this issue, along with your Commissioner McDonald, and when one of these issues has come up and we talk about it amongst ourselves, generally there's been a workaround, and it's not ideal, but generally we're still able to work with our law enforcement partners. But ultimately, I completely agree, it's something that should be looked at, and I would encourage, if it hasn't already been done, to look at Philadelphia, Chicago, and parts of California.
And I would add this from the state perspective, as as a state prosecutor, we're charged and tasked with enforcing the law, the state laws. We're not legislators. I talk about this frequently when I talk. We're the executive branch, and we're charged with enforcing the laws that our lawmakers deem to be the criminal laws of our state. And that's true for every state in the United States and every district attorney's office. So if that is our charge and our mission, it's our responsibility.
Thanks much.
Thank you. Other commissioners? Other commissioners with questions? Well, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and most valuable testimony, and certainly the responses to questions from our commissioners. On behalf of Attorney General Barr and his leadership staff, Rachel Bissick and Jeff Avita, and all the commissioners, your contributions about it today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in their deliberations and their work. Before we end the call today, just a reminder to the commissioners and our listening audience that our last call this week is tomorrow, Thursday, April the 9th. It will start at 11 a.m. and run until noon. We're receiving testimony about violent criminal gangs tomorrow. And just to give you commissioners a notice, a heads up notice, if you will, next week, Wednesday, April the 15th, our commission call will be from 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. This schedule adjustment is based on the availability of our panelists for that day. Any questions or comments from commissioners? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you again, commissioners, for your dedication and commitment. Please be safe.
Yeah.
Thanks to all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.